Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to this edition of NewsHour from the BBC World Service. My name's Paul Henley. We're coming to you live from London. What Israel called precise strikes on military targets in Iran have been described as limited by most observers, including those in Iran itself. There were explosions in the country's capital, Tehran, overnight, and two Iranian soldiers were killed. Israel said it was responding to Iran's firing of almost 200 ballistic missiles more than 3 weeks ago. This was recorded from a spot close to the ASP shopping centre in northern Tehran. The United States was briefed on the strikes beforehand, but did not have any involvement in the Israeli operation. That's according to the Pentagon. We'll be discussing that later. Israel said the three waves of attacks had achieved their goals. An Israeli military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, announced the completion of the military strikes on Iran.
I can now confirm that we have concluded the Israeli response to Iran's attack against Israel. We conducted targeted and precise strikes on military targets in Iran, thwarting immediate threats to the state of Israel. The Israel Defense Forces has fulfilled its mission. If the regime in Iran were to make the mistake of beginning a new round of escalation, we will be obligated to respond. Our message is clear. All those who threaten the state of Israel and seek to drag the region into wider escalation will pay a heavy price.
So how is what happened playing among Iranian people? These Tehran residents shared their views about the escalating situation following the Israeli attack.
Unfortunately, now that war has erupted in the Middle East, we're afraid it will affect us too, that it will be drawn here as well. This is our fear. Why should we live without peace? Why can't we live in happiness and bliss? Why? These questions have been troubling me.
War is frightening. As the saying goes, everyone has concerns about what happens during a war. The harms of war worry everyone. But I don't believe a terrible war will happen in Iran.
If they attack, we, the workers, are the ones who will be crushed.
Well, let's hear now about what Israel might be trying to achieve militarily with this latest offensive on Iran. Shashank Joshi is the defence editor of The Economist magazine. First, what were the targets? How significant were they?
We know that these were military targets. We know that there were multiple waves. Some of them targeted Iranian air defense systems, in other words, paving the way for Israeli missiles and jets to get through. They hit at least 20 targets across the country in Tehran, but also in the southwest and the west. And they appear to have hit, among other targets, military bases, S-300 air defense sites, but also production facilities for drones and missiles. That's what we know so far. There may well have been other targets that haven't yet come to light.
Many commentators are surprised that the scale of the strikes wasn't bigger. Were you?
I think it's roughly what I expected, perhaps a little bit more restrained and modest. I thought there was a risk Israel would go after senior Iranian military leadership targets in the Revolutionary Guards, including generals, because they, in their view, would count as military targets. They didn't do that. That would have been much more escalatory and aggressive. But I think given what they'd promised the Americans, that they wouldn't go after nuclear sites, they wouldn't go after oil and energy facilities, certainly not a week before a major US election, I think these are the sorts of targets I'd have expected. However, what what's interesting is we don't know how much damage they've done. It's possible they've actually inflicted quite a lot of damage on Iranian missile stocks, missile production. That would be a very, very significant strike, even if it wasn't very politically dramatic.
Israel made it clear it would strike Iran some weeks ago at a time of its choosing. Why now?
I think partly it's been a case of preparing for these strikes, making sure they have the intelligence they need, making sure they have the right munitions to penetrate to the right depths of their buried sites, making sure they can assess civilian casualties for the strikes on Iran. But also there's been a lot of diplomatic wrangling going on here. There's probably been talks with Americans about which targets were suitable, which ones wouldn't cause a regional conflagration. They've also been waiting, of course, for America's THAAD air defense system. It's sort of a substantial medium-range air defense system to come into place in Israel, so that in case Iran followed this up, the Israelis would have some additional measure of protection against another Iranian barrage. That also delayed this decision.
Saudi Arabia said a short time ago that its airspace was not used. Significant, and what route would have been taken by Israeli jets?
Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both condemned these strikes. And actually, what's really interesting is to say that at this point in time, we're seeing lots of people you might consider to be Iran's natural rivals in the region to be condemning them, distancing themselves, which shows you that Iran Gulf ties are actually sort of still fairly robust. The route they would have taken, I think, is very likely in one form or another through Syria and then Iraq. And we can say that because we know they also struck air defense systems in both Syria and Iraq. And I would imagine in some cases they may have launched their munitions from outside Iranian airspace.
Just remind us why targets in Syria and Iraq were struck this time and are continually struck by Israel.
We know that targets in Syria and Iraq are struck because there are Iran-backed militant groups active in both those countries. And indeed, Iran's Revolutionary Guard is also active in those countries. But just to be clear, in this round, all I'm aware of at present is that the air defense sites in those countries were struck. That may not have been directly aimed at punishing those militias or those countries. It may simply have been aimed at creating a safe, secure corridor for Israeli jets to pass through without fearing they might be targeted or shot down by surface-to-air missiles.
Do you think there would have been an element in the Israeli government saying tone these strikes down?
I think, if anything, probably the opposite. We saw Yair Lapid, the sort of centrist opposition leader today, saying that the government should have inflicted more damage. I'm sure there would have been other voices saying, ignore the Americans, go after nuclear sites, go after the Iranian leadership. This is our opportunity, having dismantled Hezbollah, having put Hamas on its knees, killed Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas. This is our chance to encourage regime change in Iran, destroy the remnants of their nuclear program and nuclear sites. So if anything, I think actually American pressure has really restrained the scope of this. All I'll say on that is, though, that this is not the end, and we should all view these as a sequence of strikes, a campaign. I'd be very surprised if, you know, in the next several months, perhaps sooner, we didn't see more ambitious Israeli action against Iran in one form or another.
That was Shashank Joshi, who is the defense editor of The Economist magazine, with his assessment of the latest strikes on Iran. Now, we'll get some reaction from Tehran later in the programme. Let's go to Israel now. Ruth Wasserman Lande is a former Israeli MP with the opposition Yesh Atid party. She is a former diplomat, served as an advisor to former Israeli President Shimon Peres. She also continues to act as a reserve in the Israeli Defence Forces. Ruth Lande, welcome to the programme. Thank you for joining us. Do you think the government in Israel...
May I just correct, the Yesh Atid party, but the blue and white. Benny Gantz's party, the blue and white.
Right, sorry for that mistake. Do you think the Israeli government will feel it has achieved what it wanted to achieve here?
So allow me to say that there's a difference between how the attack is perceived to people that are not necessarily very much acquainted with the objectives, with the damage that was inflicted and so on. It seemed almost like a little limited to the expectations that were there. On the other hand, Israel set out a set of objectives, and it has indeed met those objectives, in my humble opinion, for the time being, and given those restrictions that the entire world heard and understands prior to the elections in the United States of America. So according to those limited objectives, yes, those objectives were met.
Right. Given that, then, and if Iran does not retaliate, it's a big if, could this be an end to the attack and counterattack pattern?
First of all, allow me to say that the Iranians, or rather the Islamic Republic of Iran, has been attacking Israel just about forever. Even before October 7th, it rained rockets on civilians in the south of Israel, and everybody just seems to think that that was a normal state of being that Israeli civilians should live with. No. The 7th of October, Hezbollah, the West Bank, Gaza, all of this in its entirety, including right now as we speak, trucks of armaments going across from Iraq, which is ruled by the Islamic Republic of Iran, to Syria, also very much infiltrated by the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to prepare yet another front against Israel. So Iran is constantly attacking Israel. This needs to be in the context and the understanding of any kind of response to your question. And no, I don't believe that this is the end of it, because there is an incessant, constant obsession amidst the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership to destroy Israel. But again, reiterating what I always say, this is just the first step. They've done this in Iraq. They've done this in Yemen. They did this in Lebanon and in Syria. They are trying for years to do the same thing in Jordan.
Do you see any end in sight, though, to direct attacks? You're talking about, I know, Iranian attacks through proxies.
But right.
In terms of these direct tit-for-tat attacks between Israel and Iran, can you see an end to those?
Yes, I can see, but not for the time being, let's say, until the American elections. I believe that there will be quiet. I do not see that this is the end of the tit-for-tat, as you yourself had called it, between Israel and the Islamic Republic of Iran directly. One of the reasons, because Iran will simply not stop its obsession via the proxies, but also directly.
So it is your sense that Israel restricted these attacks to military targets because of U.S. pressure?
One of the issues is the U.S. pressure, no doubt. I would call it a respect for an ally. But for the time being, and I reiterate again, I say this is for the time being, because it's a very sensitive time framework in the United States, given the elections in 10 days. But this is a threat against the entire world, including the UK, including the United States of America. Intelligence facilities understand and know that. One cannot hide from it. It's very, very overt and obvious. And therefore, this cannot be the last attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran. And here I stress, not against the people of Iran. And that was very obvious in the Israeli attack, which is something that also needs to be taken into account.
Many thanks. That's Ruth Wasserman Lande, who's a former Israeli MP with the Blue and White Party, opposition party in Israel. You're listening to the BBC World Service. We're live from London. We're NewsHour. Coming up, as Japan prepares to go to the polls tomorrow, we hear how corruption has left voters unimpressed by the candidates on offer.
It's so hard to choose which party. I think people are losing interest in the elections. I'll go to vote because it's a duty as a Japanese national, but I don't really have anyone in particular I want to vote for.
The headlines this hour: Iran says it has a duty to defend itself after a wave of Israeli airstrikes on military sites overnight, but is also mindful of its responsibility to regional peace. The United States has urged Tehran not to respond to break the cycle of escalation. I'm Paul Henley and this is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. People in Georgia on the eastern fringe of Europe are voting in what many see as one of the most important parliamentary elections there since independence from the Soviet Union more than 30 years ago. The Georgian Dream Party, increasingly pro-Russian, has governed for 12 years and is hoping to extend its hold on power. It's being challenged by a number of opposition groupings who accuse it of jeopardising moves to join the European Union. It's led to a highly polarised campaign, with both sides saying the country's future direction is at stake. Let's talk to our correspondent in the capital, Tbilisi, Rayhan Dimitri. She joins us live. Rayhan, how stark a choice do you say Georgians are taking?
Well, if you listen to the voters and what they're saying, and we've spent a bit of time today going to different polling stations, then the choice could not be more starker than it is. So a lot of young voters, they're saying that their country's future as part of Europe is at stake. And they fear that somehow the Georgian Dream Party, which has already been in power for 12 years, that it will stay in power. And I spoke to some of the voters just a short while ago, and here are some of their voices.
I think this is the turning point election. I think this is like where the path is decided, whether Georgia goes to Russia or towards Europe. And I hope that we will go to Europe, though I have my fears.
Peace is the main for Georgia, and I respect USA and the European Union, but I think that the main is Georgia for me.
I hope that the Georgian Dream will not win, and I hope the government will change tomorrow. It was very nerve-wracking since it was my first election.
Rayhan, what could the ramifications be if Georgians decide to move away from Europe?
Well, I think perhaps it's too early to go to those scenarios because this, as you just said, Paul, this has been highly anticipated elections ever since we saw mass protests in the streets of Tbilisi and other cities back in April. And it was the time when the government was pushing through the so-called foreign influence law, which was described by the European Union, by other parties.
We're increasingly having problems with the line to Georgia. We'll rejoin Rayhan Dimitri, if it's possible, a bit later. That was Rayhan Dimitri reporting from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. To Cuba now, which is suffering from severe power outages. The government there has told all non-essential state workers to stay at home and ordered schools and universities to remain shut until next week. The country is still struggling to return to normal following a nationwide blackout which left around 10 million Cubans without power for several days last week. Adding to the problems on the communist-run island, Hurricane Oscar left a trail of destruction as it hit the northeastern coast of Cuba, leaving several dead and hundreds homeless. As the BBC's Will Grant reports from the island, for some communities, this energy crisis is far from over.
As Cuba approached 72 hours without power, Yuseli Perez turned to the only resource left available, firewood. No canisters of liquefied gas had been delivered to her Havana neighbourhood for weeks. So when the island's entire electrical grid also went down, Yuseli was forced to take desperate measures. My husband went from neighbourhood to neighbourhood, but couldn't find charcoal anywhere, she explains. We had to pick up firewood wherever we found it, on the street. Thankfully, it was dry and we've been able to cook. She nods at the yuca, frying slowly in a pot of lukewarm oil, because we've gone for 2 days without eating a thing. It was at night that the full extent of the blackout became clear. Havana's streets plunged into near total darkness as residents sat on the doorsteps in the stifling heat, their faces lit up by their mobile phones, for as long as the batteries lasted. Some, like restaurant worker Victor, were growing openly dismissive of the Cuban authorities.
The ones that have all the answers are those who run the country. And they have to explain themselves to the Cuban people. Because they're building so many hotels, right? Everyone knows that building a hotel doesn't cost a couple of bucks. It costs $300 or $400 million. So then, why is their energy infrastructure collapsing? Because they're not investing in it. Or if they are investing in it, then it's not working to the benefit of the people. And this is just one of so many other issues.
At the height of the crisis, the country's energy and mines minister, Vicente de la Hong, took to the airwaves to insist the country's creaking energy infrastructure was the direct result of what he called the brutal U.S. economic embargo on Cuba. Still, normal service would be resumed soon, he said. Almost no sooner than he uttered those words than there was another total collapse of the grid. While the lights did eventually come back on in much of Havana, for many places in Cuba, normal service still means going for most of the day without power. Marbellis Aguilera is getting used to living without electricity. What residents in the capital endured for a few days is daily life in her village of Aguacate. As she boils coffee on a makeshift charcoal stove, the young mother of three says her community is in dire need of state assistance. We've had no power for 6 days, she says. It came on for a couple of hours last night before it went out again. So we have no choice but to cook like this, just to provide something warm for the children, she adds.
For a village like Aguacate, living without electricity is the new normal. They've been struggling with this situation, they tell me, since around the start of the COVID pandemic, which coincided with a sharp economic downturn on the island. The problem for the Cuban authorities is that the sight of people cooking with firewood and charcoal in the 21st century is more reminiscent of the kind of poverty they say took place under the dictator Fulgencio Batista, who the Cuban revolutionaries knocked out of power some 6.5 decades ago.
Hay toda la disposición y toda la capacidad y todo el despliegue y envergadura.
With discontentment growing, the president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, a civilian and a bureaucrat, appeared on state TV wearing the revolutionaries' traditional olive-green fatigues. If that message wasn't clear enough, he directly warned against any protests over the blackout, saying the authorities would not tolerate vandalism or a social uprising, as followed the last major national blackout in July 2021.
Eso es una convicción y eso es un principio.
Meanwhile, on the northeastern coast, especially in the town of Baracoa, the situation couldn't be much worse. As people were dealing with the blackout, Hurricane Oscar made landfall, bringing high winds, flash flooding and ripping roofs from homes. What little they had has gone. While the storm may have passed, Cubans know that such is the precarious state of the island's energy infrastructure, and so entrenched are the problems in electricity generation, that the next 4-day-long blackout could happen at any time.
That was the BBC's Will Grant reporting from Cuba. And a quick pointer, given we lost contact with our correspondent in Georgia a few minutes ago, you might want to keep up to date with the ongoing voting and results in Georgian elections via the BBC website. This is the BBC World Service. We're live from London. This is NewsHour.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Let's head to San Antonio, Texas now, where NewsHour's James Menendez has been US election reporting. But Texas isn't just about politics, it's also about its unique Tex-Mex cuisine. James has been speaking to chef Johnny Hernandez, who is one of the biggest names in the business.
Well, it's a lovely late afternoon in San Antonio in autumn. Temperatures still high up in the 20s. Very balmy here, and we're sitting outside on a terrace at a restaurant called La Gloria, well known here in the city, Mexican restaurant. And with the chef and owner, Johnny Hernandez, celebrity Mexican chef. I think so. I think that's fair enough, Johnny. And we've got lots of food in front of us, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But we're here really to talk about the sort of relationship between this part of Texas and also Mexico. And I think you're ideally placed to do it, Johnny, because your family's originally from Mexico. You were born here in Texas. So my first question to you is, and I know this is a bit provocative, are you the epitome of Tex-Mex?
Well, Dad said when I was growing up in his restaurants, I'm going to send you to chef school because I don't want you making tacos all your life. So I kind of messed up. I'm still making tacos, you know. But this Tex-Mex cuisine that we've grown up around, I think it's gone through a transition. But at the core of Tex-Mex food, it's fresh ingredients. It's fresh tortillas, handmade. You know, it's sometimes Tex-Mex food gets a bad rap sometimes, but it is just part of that evolution. And again, my restaurant, La Gloria.
Are you trying to do something a little bit different? Are you trying to make it a bit more Mex than Tex?
I am more Mex-Tex than I am Tex-Mex, that's for sure. But I mean, that's always been my journey. And I've gone to the north of Mexico because that's where Dad was from and traveled the north. You know, which is carne asada, cabrito.
There's that sort of goat, roasted meats. Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of grilled meats and stuff. And then Mom's family was from Michoacán, so much more corn-based diet, more central Mexico, where you see all the tamales, you see all the sopes, you see everything is in corn tortillas. And a lot of that is just, you know, the Texas terrain. You know, flour tortillas became kind of the vehicle for that workforce that needed a taco, right? Just get a taco, put it in, let's get on the road, let's get to work.
So tell us what we've got in front of us on the table here. I mean, wonderful colors, lots of reds and greens and the yellow of the tortilla chips. But these three dishes, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, is raw fish and seafood, a sort of ceviche, which to my mind is Peruvian.
Well, look, this is more of an aguachile.
So what is that? Just tell us what aguachile is.
So aguachile means fire water, ¿verdad? And the original aguachiles in Sonora along the coast on the Pacific side, you know. So, I mean, they're representative to me of a little bit of the Texas coast.
Everyone listening is just going to be, they're going to be salivating at all these descriptions. You famously cooked at the White House for President Obama. Did you serve him this sort of thing? What was on the menu then?
I served ceviche verde. So I had asked the president's staff if I could have the honor of serving the first tacos in the White House. So they granted me that permission.
Is that true? They never had tacos.
Not proper tacos. Not proper tacos. Not out of a silver urn, that's for sure.
Tex-Mex chef Johnny Hernandez. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Iran's response to the Israeli strikes on military targets near Tehran overnight has so far been muted. The government has said that it is now entitled and obligated to defend itself, but Iranian state media have denied any significant damage has been done. I've been speaking to Syed Mohammed Mirandi in Tehran. Professor Mirandi is close to the Iranian government and their thinking.
Tehran is a very large city. Nothing landed in Tehran, in the city itself. The city is very quiet. People are at work. And actually, the markets reacted very well, which shows that they were not impressed.
And how do you react to what happened, including the deaths of two Iranian soldiers?
I think the Israeli regime's attack was underwhelming. We were expecting something much more extensive. I think it was a sign that the regime either does not have a much greater capability or that it is afraid of a punishing Iranian response. And I thought that more missiles would be able to get through Iran's air defense systems.
How do you think Iranians feel? Is there a certain sense of relief that there wasn't a bigger scale reaction?
In general, yes, Iranians were not impressed by the Israeli attack. It's clear that the regime in Tel Aviv recognizes that Iran's offensive missile capabilities are very significant and destructive. And I think that is what will deter the Israelis in future.
Well, the Israeli Defense Forces say that Iran has, quote, paid the price for its recent attacks on Israel. Your response to that?
Well, the Israeli regime is always winning. Right now, they have changed their policy towards Lebanon. They were, until now, saying that they're going to take the southern part of Lebanon and keep it. Now they're saying that their operations in southern Lebanon are going to draw down. So obviously what the regime has been saying in the past with regards to Lebanon is very different from the reality on the ground that has been imposed upon it.
What is clear is that Iranian proxies have suffered severe blows in this war, in this conflict, that Hezbollah is a much reduced force with leaders killed and capabilities reduced.
Well, I would call Israel a racist proxy of the West, but Hezbollah is not a proxy. It's an ally of Iran, as is Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the other members of the Axis of Resistance. And I think over the last 4 weeks, Hezbollah has shown itself to be very powerful. The Israeli regime has failed to take any part of southern Lebanon after a month of heavy fighting. And that shows that despite killing senior commanders and leaders in Hezbollah, their martyrdom has not had any impact on the battlefield.
How will Iran respond to what Israel did in Tehran overnight? And what support will it expect from its allies in the region?
In order for Iran to strike back at the Israeli regime, which is inevitable, Iran does not need the support of anyone else. Iran has many underground missile cities and drone cities, which have been developed since the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. Iran was surrounded by the United States, so it was preparing for a potential U.S. attack or invasion. Therefore, Iran has huge assets and huge resources. And when the time comes, the Iranians will definitely punish the regime as they did on the previous strike.
But the time is not now. Does that have something to do with U.S. elections and the fact that Iran would not like to weaken Kamala Harris's campaign and possibly destroy the chances of negotiations with the U.S. in the near future?
No, I think that the calculations in Tehran are many. One of them is that it is more effective to keep the Israeli regime guessing. A strike could be an Iranian counterstrike. Iran's retaliation could be very close, and it could be in the days ahead. I don't know. It's literally impossible for me to guess.
Professor Syed Mohammed Marandi there in Tehran. To Gaza now, where the UN human rights chief has said the war's darkest moment is taking place. Volker Türk called on world leaders to act, saying Israel was subjecting the entire population to bombing, siege and risk of starvation. At the same time, the World Health Organization says it is deeply concerned by news that hundreds of patients, health workers and other civilians are under Israeli siege at the Kamal Adwan facility in Beit Lahia, one of northern Gaza's last functioning hospitals. Dr. Hassam Abu Safir is the hospital's director. He spoke late on Thursday.
The situation actually is very bad. We don't have enough food and medication and medical supply and medical staff that we can provide safe medical service in the Kamal Adwan hospitals. And we want international protections for our medical staff because we are working under stress and under fear and under bombardment. So we need the help because we have, as you see now, there is bombing in the near our hospitals.
Well, the BBC has been trying to reach people at the hospital, and on Friday, BBC Arabic's Gaza Today programme managed to speak to one woman, Mariam, who was forced to evacuate.
My name is Mariam. Yesterday in the Kamal Adwan hospital, soldiers came to arrest doctors, but left before doing so, so we were a little reassured. They returned today at dawn with about 18 tanks that besieged the hospital. I saw no armed men, though the Israeli army were calling on gunmen to get out. What gunmen do they talk about? Their drones can see inside our rooms, and they know that there are no weapons and no gunmen. I was lying on the ground because I was extremely afraid of bullets, but I was hit by shrapnel in my back and my son was injured in the foot. He kept screaming from pain. They asked us to get out, but no one came out. Then they started shooting randomly, and the bullets started coming into the rooms. My son was shot in the face. They then told us to stand in lines, a line for young men, a line for women, and a third for nurses and doctors. Then they ordered the young men to undress and took them away in their underwear, one by one. Then we, the women, went out. Tanks were everywhere until we reached the Indonesian hospital, and then from the Indonesian hospital to the south. My son is now injured, and I can't find a cure for him.
Mariam, speaking from northern Gaza. Japanese voters head to the polls tomorrow, Sunday, in a snap election. It was called only days after the new Prime Minister, Shigeru Ishiba, was selected as the leader of the governing Liberal Democratic Party, tarnished by a scandal. His predecessor, Fumio Kishida, had essentially been forced out. Our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Khalil, has been speaking to Japanese voters.
Outside Seijuu Gakuen, my station in central Tokyo, a fresh new Liberal Democratic Party candidate is standing next to big posters of herself and talking about how hard the economic situation has been and how important it will be for her to support small businesses and do something about wages. It's not a big crowd. Some people are listening and many are making their way in and out of the station. There are the customary handshakes and group photos with supporters. It feels like business as usual here, but campaigning is happening at a turbulent time in Japanese politics. Japanese elections are not exciting affairs. In fact, they're normally boring and steady. This snap election, however, is neither. The political funding corruption scandal, which was revealed at the end of last year and implicated senior MPs and cabinet members of the LDP, tarnished the party's image and angered the public.
What a wretched state the ruling party is in. That is what I feel most.
Michiko Hamada has always voted for the opposition, the Constitutional Democratic Party of Japan. But this time, she tells me she's particularly angry at those in power. She tells me it's inexplicable that people continue to suffer from the cost of living crisis and the ruling party is embroiled in slush fund controversy.
The prices have gone up. Now I pay 10,000 yen or 20,000 yen extra for the food per month. I'm not buying the same things I used to. I'm trying to save up, but it still costs more.
When the slush fund scandal came out, how did you feel? What was your reaction to that?
It is tax evasion for a large amount of money, and a lot of politicians are doing it, and yet they pretend they have nothing to do with it. That is unforgivable.
This snap election is a political gamble, but Japan's Liberal Democratic Party is desperate to restore its tarnished image among a public that is struggling with a stagnant economy, high prices, and wages that have not risen for 30 years. This while senior LDP lawmakers are being investigated for pocketing millions of dollars of political fundraising money over a period of 5 years. Yumi Sato tells me the ruling party should be punished at the ballot box because of this scandal.
It will affect this election, and I hope so. Because sometimes people get angry, but some people still vote for LDP because, in my life, I always support for LDP, but this time, I would like to ask people to think what they did.
In addition to the anger and frustration, there is the issue of political apathy and low voter turnout here in Japan. In the 2021 elections, for example, just over half the population cast their ballots. Even those who normally vote for the LDP are now unsure. Miyuki Fujisaki, an LDP supporter, tells me she still can't make up her mind.
It's so hard to choose which party. I think people are losing interest in the elections. I'll go to vote because it's a duty as a Japanese national, but I don't really have anyone in particular I want to vote for.
Why are people losing interest?
The LDP has the slush fund issues, but the opposition also doesn't stand out. They sure complain a lot, but they're not clear on what they want to do. I have a daughter who has the right to vote too, and we talk about the election a lot, but we don't know who to vote for.
Urawa Station on the outskirts of Tokyo is bustling with the evening rush of commuters hurrying home. Some have stopped by a fruit and vegetable stand for some quick shopping. Chia Shimizu is a pensioner who tells me she now must work part-time to make ends meet.
I'm struggling. My hourly wage has gone up a bit, but it doesn't match the prices.
The Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba, a longtime politician who previously served as a defense minister, has described the snap election as the people's verdict. But it's after the election that the real challenge begins. Japan is facing a shrinking and aging population and a region that is increasingly unstable. Those in power will have to deal with the country's sluggish economy and find a way to raise wages. More crucially, they'll have to regain the respect and the trust of a public that's grown weary of the country's politics.
That was the BBC's Shaima Khalil reporting from Japan. BBC World Service, this is NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. We return to our main story now. Israel having struck Iran overnight with air missiles. The attacks were targeted on specific military sites, according to the Israeli government. It was a cooler response, though, to the Iranian attack on Israel at the start of October than many had expected. Reports say that the toned-down approach was due to US intervention. So what does this say about the precarious US-Israeli relationship, especially right now when an election is just around the corner? With me to explain is Andrew Tabler, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former US National Security Council director. Mr. Tabler, welcome to the program. What kinds of talks do you think took place between Israel and the US before these strikes?
Probably the most extensive you can have. Cabinet members right down the line speaking with the Israeli leadership, trying to calibrate a response. The response from Israel was inevitable to Iran's last attack. The question was how and when and to what degree. And the U.S. and Israel, I think, cooperated very closely on this response, which, as you pointed out earlier, and I'm paraphrasing here, was measured and calibrated.
So is this proof that Israel does listen to the U.S.? Many had started to doubt it.
Yes, Israel does listen to the U.S. Now, whether they'll listen to the U.S. In response to whatever Iran now is going to do is another matter. But it was Israel had to make clear to Iran that it couldn't attack the Israeli homeland, the mainland, without a direct response back. The question is, does Iran take an off-ramp now? Is there another response, which is also calibrated? It's just another rung on the ladder of escalation that we've seen over the last year.
So what about the calls for restraint in the conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza? How are they going?
Well, that's another matter altogether. I think there's compartmentalization concerning the direct attack between Israel and Iran. In Lebanon, Israel has been going salami slice by salami slice through Hezbollah, destroying its senior leadership. And so I think Israel, if it doesn't get the deal that it wants, which is Hezbollah pulling back from the Israeli frontier and allowing Israeli civilians to return, then they're going to continue that operation. Same goes for Gaza. If Hamas is still operating, still capable of firing into Israel, I think the Israelis will continue there. And of course, in the last 24 hours, we've seen Israeli action in the northern part of the Gaza Strip.
How important are the U.S. elections in everything that's taking place in the Middle East right now?
I think they're extremely important. Contextually, everyone in the region knows how close the U.S. election is. It's probably the closest. It's being described as the closest ever. We're approaching our 250th anniversary as a country, but it really is close. And so therefore, any kind of flap of the butterfly's wing, politically that is, can affect the outcome. The question is, what kind of flap. And we don't really know that, but war in the Middle East is something that doesn't stay there. What happens there doesn't stay there. And particularly as pertains to energy prices, but Israel did not target so far Iran's energy infrastructure or its other nuclear facilities. And that would have set up, I think, a larger conflagration.
Many thanks for coming on the program. That's Andrew Tabler, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, former U.S. National Security Council director. Let's talk to our correspondent, our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, who's joined me in the studio. The message seems to be this could be the end of tit-for-tat attacks between Israel, direct attacks between Israel and Iran. Could it?
It could. I mean, the Israelis are saying that that is it for now. And obviously, it's clear that the ball is now in Iran's court. And for some of those reasons that you've already discussed on the program, Iran's going to have to think pretty long and hard about what it intends to do, if anything, by way of a response, because it knows that whatever it is capable of doing to Israel, Israel is more than capable of delivering much heavier blows. And when you bear in mind that it isn't just what Iran is able to do with its own equipment, it's also what Iran is able to do with its allies and proxies around the region. And those allies and proxies, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Gaza, groups in Iraq, have all been on the receiving end of very, very severe attacks for months now. And so Iran's toolbox is very, very diminished. And that gives it fewer options when it comes to trying to retaliate. Having said that, I mean, there are two things worth bearing in mind about what happened last night. For the first time in, 30, 40 years, the people of Tehran woke up to an attack on their city. That has not happened since the tail end of the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. And secondly, Israel, for the first time ever, publicly admitted, announced that it was doing what it was doing. They've never done that before. So this shadow war between Iran and Israel is now right out in the open. And of course, the scope for escalation, another rung along that ladder, as Andrew Tabler was talking about, is very real. And that can be deliberate or it can be accidental.
There have been critical noises from some countries about these Israeli strikes from countries that are not allies of Iran. How do you read the overall mood in the region at the moment?
Well, you know, I think you're going to hear those sort of rather formulaic condemnations. You heard them from the UAE, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt. But they all said in their statements that they were calling for utmost restraint. And that was a clear message to Iran, with whom they have rather better relations now than they used to. Iran has cultivated and sort of returned somewhat to, you know, a modicum of decent diplomatic relations with these countries.
And it said it has responsibility for peace in the region, hasn't it?
Yes. And so, you know, those countries who frankly may not be that dismayed at the spectacle of Iranian power and influence being steadily degraded, albeit at the hands of Israel, you know, they clearly do not want Iran to take this any further, because we are getting perilously close to something that could involve them.
And a word on the strength of US diplomacy here?
Well, you know, you've just talked about the American election and just how crucial that is, and that's just a kind of straitjacket that the Americans are working in at the moment. The feeling that nothing can be done that is going to anger one constituency or another and wreck Joe Biden's, or rather Kamala Harris's, chances of being elected. So, you know, they are constrained in that sense. There is clearly an effort to try and get ceasefire talks, both for Gaza and Lebanon, back off the ground, but we don't quite know where they've got to yet.
Many thanks. That's our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, wrapping up this edition of NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you can join us again soon. From the whole team, bye-bye for now.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.